roll, please.
Senator Eisen, Senator Josephson.
Here.
Senator John.
Here.
Senator Ziegler, Chairman Ray.
Here. Quorum present. First order of business will be Senate Bill 167. Michael Stark, come identify yourself, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Michael Stark. I'm with the Department of Law. Here to testify on Senate Bill 167. Mr. Chairman, when we were here before the committee on Friday, the committee expressed some concern about the suggestion that I proposed in terms of reducing, increasing the amount of good time for prisoners from 1 day for every 3 day served to 1 day for every two. The committee indicated some interest in entertaining the possibility of increasing good time for certain classes of prisoners, principally those who were first-time offenders. Mr. Endell, who's the Director of Division of Corrections, is also here today. He has some representations to make to the committee in that regard. So prior to proposing an amendment to the bill, which would do what I think the committee indicated interested in, perhaps we would hear from Mr. Endell on the good time provision first.
As long as it's not long-winded and is directed to the point, we have a long agenda today. You can stay there.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Roger Endell, Director of the Division of Corrections, and I will be succinct. There's a difficulty with doing anything tampering, if you will, with the good time provisions in legislation, any legislation that I'm concerned with. For one thing, we have at least three different time accounting systems that we're dealing with right now that have come into being over a period of several years, as many as 10 to 15 years. So the people who are computing time are different correctional institutions have to be cognizant of when this man was arrested and under which time accounting system. And my chief concern is that I would like to have one accounting system that applies to all people across the board who are sentenced to do time in the state of Alaska or outside the state of Alaska, the Federal Bureau of Prison System. And so my concern is not so much with how that time is computed, but the fact that we have one system. I would prefer, if it were possible to do so, to go on a good time provision which would permit, for example, 1 day of good time permitted for every 2 days served for good behavior. If that's not possible, then some other arrangement where good time is provided equally across the board. I'm simply saying that, two factors are involved here. One is that we can spend several millions of dollars more to build new correctional space, which we have to do anyway.
Well, Mr. Endell, the problem we had was that there was a suggestion, and I believe it was motivated by freeing up beds, and some people were to get one for every 2 days, and some people were going to get two for every 3 days, wasn't that it?
One for every three, one for every two.
One for every three, one for every two. In order to meet that suggestion, the committee felt that they wanted to regulate it in some manner that those people who had serious crimes and had mandatory sentences, perhaps, they would be under one system, and those who had presumptive sentences, depending upon the severity of the crime, of course, would get the lighter or would receive more good time because they would be less of a problem to the public when we let loose, and that was what we were striving to do. Actually, I don't know who Mr. Stark, if he represents you or just the Department of Law, but he came in with one idea, and you know, you're saying a different idea, and well, kind of like to have somebody representing the administration have a concise idea as to just exactly what you want, and we'll try to fashion one to fit.
Well, I think in fairness, to Mr. Stark. He's done a good job. He's had difficulty because I'm working with a dozen different balls in the air and on correctional issues, and it is difficult for me, for him to pin me down, so that's my fault. All I'm trying to say here is it's, of course, up to you folks to decide how good time should be acquired and applied in our system, but it's creating, or it will create, very serious problems for us. As a matter of fact, we've already had experienced problems where a couple of inmates have been kept beyond their release dates, and most of it relates to the confusion in regard to which time accounting system is to be applied to these people. It seems to me that what the state should do, it would be in the best interest of the state to have one time accounting system applied equally to all people. It is possible to have several different, as you suggest, several different ways of applying time, but it is extremely difficult. For one thing, these inmates transfer around from one institution to another while they're serving their sentences, and it makes time accounting very hazardous, very difficult. In fact, 10 years back in 71, when I was searched with corrections, we had one time accounting system. It was a block system. Various people didn't like it because the inmate's time was lopped off at the beginning, and then he served the rest of his time. So then they came in with a system that said that roughly one-third of his time would be knocked off, and then it became one-half, and now we're talking about, I'm sorry, not knocked off, it's the other way around. He served, he had a minimum of one-third to serve, and time would be taken away approximately one-third would be good time. But we've become more and more conservative, and people are asking me, why are jails and prisons overcrowded? There's a whole variety of reasons. This is one of the contributing factors, not totally responsible for the situation, but it has contributed. If people serving more serious crimes are to get less good time, that can, of course, can be done, but it creates an accounting nightmare. People who go on furlough may get more good time than people who are not on furlough. They're again contributing to the accounting nightmare. So it's really very complex. What I'm urging,
Senate Bill 167 will be considered at another time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senate Bill 133.
Chairman, we're ready to roll now. Mr. Chairman, we got the advisor from David this morning, and the only thing that I can think of, sir, and it's what I've already told you, is that the letter that you put out, which you itemized the various materials which were going
to. Did you get the latest letter that they just sent?
Yes, and I would say,
Mr. Deardorff just sent a letter. Would you sit down here, Mr. Deardorff?
Well, I'd like to see if he agrees with me. I think what we ought to do, David, if at all possible,
could we let him identify himself, Senator? David Deardorff, advisor of statutes. There you go.
Is to disseminate everything we've had up to your most recent letter and add that to it in a letter that Senator Ray or me, if he directs me so to do, to put on every senator's desk with the suggestion that if there are any questions, to contact any one of the people who've been involved, for example, Mr. Gabrielli, Guy Van Doren, yourself, hopefully not the chairman or me, but with the idea in mind that Senator Ray will prevail upon his Rules Committee Chairman to not calendar the bill for 1 week, so that anybody who really cares about the revisor statute can come and get the answers to his or her questions prior to the day we take it up on the floor. And as Senator Ray knows, I've been involved with these statutes, revisors bills, for a long, long time, and once you start to nitpick them on the floor, why, you're there forever. So I think the better approach is to give everybody warning of what you're going to do before you do it.
I gave you that bill because I know of your masochistic streak of long standing, and I didn't want to interrupt that going down the line.
I will write the letter, again, much akin to the letter that's already in the file, but I'm going to add the most recent letter we received from counsel as one of the...
Do you want to make a motion on this bill, Senator?
I move it out with individual recommendations, and we follow the game plan as to calendaring what
right.
I suggested.
I don't have any problem with that. Do you mind? How many do pass? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. actually, that's Senate Bill 241. We have quite a few people who are interested in testifying. I wonder if we can just start off, and if it's agreeable with the committee, we can just start off and listen to some of the testimony. And I suppose the testimony is more or less in the nature of support or opposition to the bill, and hopefully whatever changes that could be recommended could be identified by those people who are giving the testimony. Celia Kleinkopf, come forward please and identify yourself and give whatever testimony you believe desirable.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Cecilia Kleinkopf. I'm here representing the Alaska chapter of the National Association of Social Workers. Our organization is very supportive of Senate Bill 241 and does not, at the present time, recommend any changes in it. Very briefly, I have provided each member of the committee with a short synopsis and summary and analysis of the bill, which I won't repeat in great detail. But then we'll be available for questions. In essence, Senate Bill 241 does several things, amending both the state's adoption statutes under Title 47, as well as the vital records statutes. What Senate Bill 241 intends to do is to provide non-identifying information to an adult adoptee on request without any necessity for a court order. And Senate Bill 241 lists 10 items which would constitute what is meant by non-identifying information. In Section 2, Senate Bill 241 also intends to arrange for access to identifying information, which would be names of the biological parents of the person who was subsequently adopted. But Senate Bill 241 provides that access to that information, identifying information, shall only be available with the consent of the person to be identified.
You know there is a committee, there are sponsor substitute.
Yes.
Yes, all right.
I'm sorry, Senator,
that's
I should
right.
have been referring to
that's
sponsor substitute
right,
for Senate Bill 241. Yes. Further, Section 2 provides that the Bureau of Vital Records shall attach to the original certificate of birth the consent form, which was filed by either the adult adoptee or the biological parent, indicating their permission to release identifying information. In other words, that information could be gathered and then would have to be attached to the original birth certificate, which would indicate whether or not the biological parent permitted their name to be released. The committee should be aware that the Bureau of Vital Records for a number of years has been releasing original birth certificates to adult adoptees in the state of Alaska. And they are doing so under regulations which were promulgated for the Bureau of Vital Records a number of years ago. So that both vital records statutes and adoption statutes presently prohibit the release of that information, but regulations are enabling the Bureau to provide that information. So this bill is an attempt to address that concern in statute. Concern about the possibility of the state's liability for releasing confidential information.
And is it my understanding you do support the bill or you do not support the bill?
We do support the bill, Senator. We support it very strongly.
Are there any questions from any of the senators? Thank you very kindly. Joyce Lanier? Do you identify yourself, ma'am, before their testimony is signed by the bill?
Mr. Ray, my name is Joyce Lanier. I am a real mother. I love my five-year-old Jonathan more than I ever thought I could love John. And because I love him, someday I will encourage his search for his first mother. Love is secure, not jealous. Love lets go. Love is free. Love shares. Jonathan may, like so many other adoptees, search for his birth parents to fill a void that will inevitably open in his life as he grows older, a void created by unanswered questions. So such as who am I, where did I come from, who do I look like, do I have brothers and sisters, are there medical problems I may likely inherit, and what am I worth if I was given away? Jonathan is fortunate to have been born in Alaska, for it is one of the few states that allow adult adoptees to see their original birth certificates, and that certificate names his birth parents, their ages, and birthplaces. That is his first stepping stone to going back in history and tracing his own genealogy. How potent history will become for him when he has an ancestor to identify with it. Having access to the names of his birth parents will also provide him with an avenue to seek his true identity. He may not wish to actually contact them, for most adoptees are not looking for a relationship with their other parents. Mom and Dad will always be Mom and Dad, one adoptee assured me. Most likely, though, he will find his other parents receptive. Over 90% of birth parents favor open adoption records. Only 1% do not welcome contact with the adoptee. Adoptees search for the facts of their lives, facts that may seem insignificant to others, but in the absence of them, an adoptee's life is everything. I think every person has a right to his identity and an heredity. Yet this bill would treat adult adoptees as forever children, incapable of handling the truth of their origins. Adoptees who do decide to search for their roots accept the risk that their discoveries might not be pretty, but their risk is overshadowed by their compelling need to complete themselves with facts to replenish their fantasies. What they find may be awful, but it's more awful being confronted by somebody telling you, no, we cannot give you that original birth certificate. It's difficult for me to understand why Alaska would want to step back from censoring. Laws of most states were written decades ago when it was a social disgrace to be an unwed mother, and they were written to supposedly protect the child from the embarrassment of illegitimacy and to enable the mother to keep her secret and the adopted parent a stable home. But times have changed. No longer is it a social disgrace to be a single. In fact, society now recognizes it's not the fault of a child. Indeed, unwed mother is a term that's disappearing and being replaced by the socially accepted word single parent. Most single parents or mothers, in fact, keep their babies. Only 1 in 10 is able to part with the child. As other states are beginning to examine their laws, such as New Jersey, North Carolina, and Nebraska, and as more and more adoptees and birth parents are organizing themselves into groups such as ALMA and CUB, which is Adoptees Liberation Movement, and Concern United Birth Parents. They're challenging laws and courts to facilitate their searches for each other. And as more and more is being learned and written about the emotional effects of adoption on the adoptee as well as the birth parent, we sit here today contemplating denying the already 14,000 plus adopted people in Alaska access to their original birth certificate. Because that's in effect what Senate Bill 241 included in. We live in a mobile society. Few of the birth parents will hear of the requirement of this bill, and many may have already died. I don't believe the state registrar is going to be bombarded with 28,000 consent forms to release birth certificates. I think it's time that we adopted parents and natural parents and legislators recognized our responsibilities to provide adopted children with an avenue to seek their personal identity. A child needs information such as biographical sketches, physical descriptions, sibling existence, and a medical history that are updated regularly and which is referred to in this bill as non-identifying information. When he becomes an adult, he may need the names of those parents so that he may naturally complete his picture of himself. Only birth parents can furnish that information. Only legislators can provide legal sanction for its collection, and only adoptive parents can give the child the information when they judge that the adopted child is ready for it. Possessing a knowledge of his heritage when he is a child will help the adoptee to become a mature and well-adjusted adult. We need legislation which balances the rights of the adoptee to know the identity of his birth parents, the desires of the birth parents, those few who they are, who may wish to remain anonymous, and the insecurities of any adoptive parent who may consider the entrance of the birth parents into the life of the child a threat to the stability of their adopted family. It's time that we pass legislation which ensures that the collection and periodic updating of non-identifying information on the birth parents and distribution to the child, which allows the adult adoptee and his adult descendants access to the identifying information upon request, and provides a means for birth parents and adult adoptees to state to a mutual party, such as the State Vital Statistics Office, whether or not they would welcome contact with the other, and legislation which ensures that the adoptee and birth parents are informed of the rights of the adoptee so that there are no surprises when the adult adoptee begins to search for his natural parents. We need legislation which provides adoptive parents with initial and ongoing counseling services to ensure them that the inquisitiveness of the child or adult adoptee is natural and not a threat to their own family's stability. I've left with you today a copy of the bill as I think it should be written. There are some good things in the bill, but I am opposed to the passage of the bill as it now reads. Senators, I would like for you to leave stepping stones for our adopted children, not stone walls. Thank you very much.
Do you have any questions, sir?
No.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. John C. Garvin, from out of town. Would you come forward, sir, and whatever testimony, identify yourself. And...
Thank you, Senator. I'm John Garvin, Director of Alaska Children's Services. Parent with my wife, Audrey, of 8 children. 4 of them are homemade and 4 are store-bought. The adopted children that we have are those that have given me a tremendous insight into this particular issue. And I want to support the previous testimony that was given here, and to support this bill, if that's as far as we can go right now. But I would wish that we could go further to a more totally open adoption system. The need for adoptive children to have access to the information of their birth parentage is absolutely crucial, and sometimes even life essential in regard to certain physical and the biological needs. More importantly, for many of us, though, who deal with this on a day-to-day basis, both professionally and in as an adoptive parent, it's the emotional needs that can be addressed. Each of my 4 adopted children are different. And as I observe them, they are now teenagers, they go through different stages in their life. Kenneth, who's the oldest right now, is very much interested in his parentage. David, his adopted, our adopted 16-year-old, could not care less at the present time in his life. It's a decision that those young people have to make in relation to their seeking the information that needs to be open to them. And so I want to speak in favor of this bill if it is as far as we possibly can go right now, hoping that it is only a stepping stone to even more open adoptions and adoptive system here in the state of Alaska.
Thank you, sir. Do you have any questions, sir?
No, I don't.
Thank you very much. Jan and Kim Ivey, would you like to come up together, perhaps? Give each one moral support?
I guess not.
All right. You identify yourself, ma'am, and give whatever testimony you feel desirable.
Yes, I am Jan Ivey. I've lived most of my life in Alaska. I am an adopted parent of 2 teenage girls who are here right now because they're concerned about this bill. They are 16 and 14 years of age. We also have 1 homely child who's not concerned about this bill and is too young at present to be concerned about it. I'm a school teacher for about 20 years, and I am also a counselor for Adoption Services of WACAP, a private child placing agency in Alaska, Washington, and Idaho. My basic belief is that adoptees should have access to their birth certificates when they are 18 or when they are at an age of majority in the state. I feel that it's not right, and I even believe that it's unconstitutional, to deny this information to a select group of Alaskans. And all other Alaskans have this information available to them. I feel that it's discriminatory, and I also feel that it implies that there was something wrong with their birth. I feel that it's not constructive to a child or to an adult to be denied this information. I also talked last year to Joan Brooks, Registrar of Statistics, and she told me that at present, that about 10 adoptees, adult adoptees, request per year their birth information. And when I asked her about it, I asked her if there was any problem resulting from this, and I asked her if any birth parent had become alarmed and contacted her as a result of it, and she said no. This was about a year ago. So I feel that the present situation is working well. I think that if this bill has to be passed, I think it's wrong for it to be retroactive for those people born before 1984. Because, for example, my own two children have been under the belief that when they reach 18, they can have access to their birth record. And now, if this bill goes ahead and says that unless the adoptive parent has specified that the information can be disclosed, it will be not allowed to them. This is on the first page, section 18.50.500. Well, it was 16 years ago for one of my children and 14 for the other. There's no way, because of the anonymity involved and because they probably are not even in the state of Alaska anymore, for those birth parents to be consulted to ask whether or not they would allow the information to be granted. So I think this is unfair to place this burden on the birth parents who probably can't be found even. At present, adoptees searching for their birth parents have great difficulty finding them, even when they know a birth mother's maiden name and a lot of times her own birth date. And of course, we have much less information on these children than that. So if the bill must be passed, I would say that it should only be specified from 1984 onwards so that any birth parent giving up a child would know that information when they decide to permit the child to be adopted. In the past, social workers have always been afraid that terrible, irreparable harm would occur to families, to birth parents, if suddenly an adoptee showed up, especially if they kept secret. Well, there are books, and there's a lot of information written on this, and I think that the fear is pretty much ungrounded. I think that some of the fear is there before a meeting actually occurs. One example is my husband's two younger siblings, a brother and a sister, from a small town in Alaska here, were adopted out when the family broke up. When we were, this is 20 years ago, we looked for the younger brother and sister, and the adoptive mother did not want any contact, even though the brother and sister were full-grown adults and were not living at home. My husband went ahead and did visit the brother and sister, and we finally did go to dinner once with the adoptive parent of these two, of this brother and sister. And although she felt threatened at first, over the years,